one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits by many waters with her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. The name written on her forehead was a mystery: Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of God's holy people, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and the beast she rides, which has seven heads and 10 horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and yet will come up out of the abyss and go to its destruction. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because it once was, now is not, and yet will come."
This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. But when he does, he must remain for only a little while. The beast who once was, and now is not, is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. The 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings, and with him will be his called, chosen and faithful followers. Then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw, where the prostitute sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the 10 horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to hand over the beast and their royal authority until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth."
Thank you for reading. I'd like you to turn to Proverbs chapter 7, and I'm going to read you a little bit of that as well. I am now going to read a little bit from Proverbs chapter 7, having read Revelation chapter 17. Proverbs 7, verse 6. "At the window of my house, I looked down through the lattice. I saw among the simple, and I noticed among the young men, a youth who had no sense. He was going down the street near her corner, walking along in the direction of her house at twilight, as the day was fading, as the dark of night set in. Then out came a woman to meet him, dressed like a prostitute with crafty intent. She is unruly and defiant. Her feet never stay at home, now in the street, now in the squares, at every corner she lurks. She took hold of him and kissed him, and with a brazen face said, 'Today I fulfilled my vows and I've food for my fellowship offering at home. So I came out to meet you. I looked for you and I found you. I've covered my bed with colored linens from Egypt. I've perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let's drink deeply of love till morning. Let's enjoy ourselves with love. My husband's not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He took his purse filled with money and won't be home till full moon. With persuasive words, she led him astray. She seduced him with her smooth talk. All at once he followed her, like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping onto a noose, till an arrow pierces his liver, like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing it will cost him his life. Now then, my sons, listen to me, pay attention to what I say. Do not let your heart turn to her ways or stray into her paths. Many of the victims she's brought down, her slain, are a mighty throng. Her house is a highway to the grave, leading down to the chambers of death. Fancy meeting her? Right, back to Revelation 17. Keep a finger perhaps in there. How gullible do you think you are? Gullibility is the measure of someone's readiness to believe something is true when it isn't. It can be a small thing. I'm sometimes the last to get a joke. I feel a bit gullible. It can be more expensive. I met a guy last year who admitted he'd been ripped off by someone on the internet claiming to be selling a van. He paid a little deposit up front, and then on the night before he was due to collect it, the guy said, there's somebody else wanting it. If you want it, you need to pay now. He paid, turned up at the venue where he was expecting to find it, and it was a private house that had no idea he'd been ripped off. Someone rings up wanting to help you sort out a problem with your bank account, and you give them your passcodes and bank account numbers. None of us want to think of ourselves as likely to fall for a con, but the reality is that no matter how streetwise we may be at business or in human relationships, there is a giant con that has been running a very long time, and we really need the warning in Revelation 17 to sink in if any of us are to stand a chance of not falling for it. Verse 9, right in the middle of the chapter, tells us the application. This calls for wisdom. We will need wisdom from God if we are going to be able to see the devil's con and grasp that what we have in Christ is vastly more valuable. So do you consider yourself gullible? That's where we're going. Don't be conned. Wisdom needed. I'm going to describe the prostitute, the city, the beast, and our encouragement at the end is play the long game. In context, we've seen that the book of Revelation was given as an encouragement to real churches with real struggles, just like ours, but back then in Asia Minor in the first century AD. It's a book that comes with a promise right at the start. Revelation chapter 1, verse 3, blessed are those who read this book, and blessed are those who hear it, because the time is near. Well, that means it couldn't be more relevant to us and to our salvation. What we've gleaned from chapter 12 is that there is a real devil and that there is a real struggle going on. The devil has been resoundingly defeated in his general plan, but he is furious at that defeat and is now attacking the people of God wherever he can. So far, we've been introduced to two main allies of the devil, two beasts, one from the sea and one from the land. That was in chapter 13. There are political regimes, governments, kings, rulers. They care nothing for God, and they are out for power and glory for themselves. And second, there is the false prophet who represents religious regimes, religious authorities, even churches, even pastors, those who inside the church would lead the sheep astray by their false teaching. So political regimes, religious regimes, and now we're introduced to a third ally of the devil. Will you recognize this ally? Verse 1 describes it or her as the great prostitute who, verse 2, has committed adultery with the king of kings, the kings of the earth. We might think prostitute and have in mind some poor impoverished girl from a broken background pressed into a degrading practice. But that's not the woman in view here. This is the great prostitute who seems to wield influence all over the world. She sat by many waters, verse 1, and we're helpfully told that the waters you saw, verse 15, are peoples and multitudes, nations and languages. So this woman isn't just on one street corner. She's in all strata of societies. She is everywhere. And what is she like? Well, she is very attractive and alluring. and seductive. Think of Glossy magazine or Sunday supplement. The woman dressed in purple and scarlet. She's sophisticated and rich. She was glittering with gold and precious stones and pearls, like the latest Hollywood or pop star. Kings seem drawn to her like moths to a flame. And the inhabitants of the earth are intoxicated by her. That means they lose all self-control around her. So this woman sounds very like the woman of Proverbs chapter 7, doesn't she? The one the writer warns every gullible young man about. Proverbs 7 verse 8, he went near her house. First mistake. At night, fool. And then he fell for her charm. Verse 10, out came a woman dressed as a prostitute with crafty intent. She took hold of him and kissed him and told him, my husband's not home. She led him astray with persuasive words and seduced him with smooth talk. And all at once, he was reduced to being like an ox heading for the slaughter. Will the reader of Revelation realize he is hearing again the warning of Proverbs 7:25? Do not let your heart turn to her ways or stray onto her paths. Only this time the warning is bigger than to one young man. It's to the whole Church of Christ. This calls for wisdom for every Christian. In the first three verses of the chapter, all of us are being asked to take a very close look at where our eyes are being drawn, which attractive thing or person has our attention, which roads we consistently walk down, and even at night, and ask, are we being taken in, conned, led astray? Why so glum? Well, adultery is what's in view. In Proverbs, it was one man gullibly being drawn away to another man's bed, thereby destroying that marriage and marring the prospect of a pure marriage of his own. But here is a much wider problem. It is the kings and the inhabitants of the earth that are being intoxicated with the wine of this woman's adulteries. At the end of verse 4, she has a golden cup in her hand. And we might think, impressive, a golden cup, except for what's in it. It is a con. It is filled with abominable things and is utterly filthy. This is a spiked drink, if ever there was one. It looks like a great cocktail, but inside it is horror. Who then is this alluring woman? The answer is in the verses that follow, perhaps. Verse 5, she helpfully has a name label written on her forehead. Babylon the Great. Babylon has been a very famous city in the past. Hanging gardens, a wonder of the world. Amazing buildings that had faded in importance by the first century AD. Nonetheless, everyone knew that Babylon stood for Babel. Babel was the first city that the inhabitants of the earth built. Do you remember? It had a tower reaching up to the heights. Why? Well, it stood for everything that was proud in human endeavor. Proud and ambitious. It's a city that says we can achieve and stand in the high places and we don't need the help of any god to do it. Now, God did humble that city and scatter that people. It was great, and then it wasn't. But then it rose again. And where were the people exiled to? Babylon. We're told by the end of chapter 18, the woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kingdoms of the earth. So do you see there's a woman and a city? Here she is with her golden cup. The adulteress of Proverbs 7 is now a great prostitute and a whole city. Clearly this is picture language. We aren't meant to have just one city or lady in mind, but what do they stand for? Well, think of cities. Cities are places to best see a culture on display, aren't they? You want to know what a society is thinking? Head for the city. Listen in the bars and the boardrooms. Cities are where ideas come together. Movements get started. They're exciting. They're attractive. They're glamorous, if you can afford to. Live in a city going in the wrong direction, however, and the culture, the attitudes, the vibe, they will have their pull on you. In a city where everybody seems to think one way, it will be very hard to think, let alone choose, to live another way. Cities are where the biggest shows are put on, the glitziest buildings get built, the wealthiest people tend to live. No wonder the idea of a city blends in with the idea of an alluring woman. But wait, how do I distinguish between what's genuinely good about the world, beauty, good experiences, nice things, good relationships, and what isn't? Should I never go to a city? Well, look what's alluring and ask, is it actually a con? Perhaps verse 6. I saw the woman was drunk with the blood of God's holy people, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. That's how to spot this woman, this city. They have little time. In fact, they are dead set against God's people. What place does Jesus Christ and his people have in those places and among these people and in your ambitions and in the experiences of ours? Is confident trust in the God who made everything and has given us everything ever expressed in this city and by that woman? Or rather, would you meet disdain and mockery? That'd be what you get. And even outrage and determined opposition to anyone who might bring God into the picture. Do we quietly censor ourselves and not even mention faith in God or hope in the resurrection of Jesus Christ because the power, attractiveness, and allure of what is in front of us, achievement, ambition, respect from the world, are they so strong? Maybe you thought, I'd hate to risk the friendships I have by mentioning Jesus. Or you think to yourself, I'd be risking my job, damaging my career. This is the picture of life for Christians in the first century everywhere. Small pockets of believers in churches seeking to go God's way, surrounded by a world going another way. And as then, so too now. Christians are those who have been found by Jesus, rescued out of a pit of blindness about life, thinking, YOLO, you only live once, and then you die, and been given hope and an eternal future. You will live forever. But they're still living in this world. We don't have a new world yet. We're a minority, resisting the pressure of the tide. Ooh, there's the city. There's the Babel. Recognize that one. Resisting the pressure of the tide, going against the flow, swimming against the tides. Do you remember those pictures from a couple of weeks ago? And all the time surrounded by so much that glitters and shines with powerfully attractive people calling for us to follow them and just join back in. Maybe you found this to be true. When someone becomes a Christian, the work of the Spirit is almost always to increasingly reveal how ugly are the contents of that golden cup. Shiny on the outside, but shady power plays are going on underneath. All that glitters is not gold. A prostitute, a city, but there is also the beast she is riding. Can you see that? We'll come back to that. Verse 3, then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert, and there I saw a woman riding on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names, had 7 heads and 10 horns. We've met this beast before in a similar guise in chapter 12. Scarlet, perhaps not because there's anything inherently wrong with the colour red. Thank goodness Arsenal, Man United, Man City, whatever it is. But it's the colour of violence and bloodshed, perhaps. This beast has a devilish origin, and it stands for evil regimes. The woman we've seen is riding this beast. She's somehow in league with it. Well, which regime, we ask? And verse 9 says the 7 heads of the beast are 7 hills on which the woman sits. Now, does that sound like a city to you? A city with 7 hills? Anyone been to Rome? Well, maybe. But actually, there's more than 7 hills in Rome, if you add them all up. And 7 kings? Well, could you write a list of 7 Roman emperors? You probably could. But there were a lot more than 7, so we can't be sure it's that either. What we do know is that in this image, there is a seductive woman riding a scarlet beast with 7 heads or kings going by the name Babylon the Great, a woman, a city, a beast in league, and all of them rallied against God's people and with influence over all the earth. Quite a striking picture. Do you know where that is? It's in Rome, and it is the Colosseum, yeah. A magnificent building, a testament to civic power and pride, seated thousands, and the entertainment in the games laid on by the emperor for the people was his gift to them. It brought people together, it lifted them out of the drudge of daily life. But what was laid on as entertainment was human cruelty on an industrial scale. Humans killing other humans or being fed to wild animals as a spectacle. Christians are said to have borne the brunt of that. Anyone who challenged the woman that is Babylon on the beast could end up in such a place. And today you challenge the culture, the sexual mores, the trends of the 21st century society, and it won't be the Colosseum where you'll be taken to pieces. It'll be social media, probably. Thankfully, we do still have laws in this country that have been profoundly shaped by Christianity, but when Babylon's power is threatened, she'll use any means to shame and bring down her opponents. So what is it to be wise when the wheels of government, the direction of culture, and the attraction of the world seem to be going against the believer? When, verse 12 to 14, the woman, the beast, and the city together have one purpose, uniting their power, what do they do, verse 14? They wage war against the Lamb. That's what's going on. And the answer is, play the long game. I don't know if that's just a sporting motif. Do you know what the long game is? It's to look to the sure outcome. Don't fall for the short con, the quick fix, the pleasure now principle. Let's glean from chapter 17 what Revelation says will happen in the end. Verse 1, John is told that he's been shown the punishment of the great prostitute who sits by the many waters. Punishment, that is what is coming to her, her kings, and the city she describes. Did you see the beast's power is not indefinite? We glean that from his description. End of verse 8, he once was, now is not, and yet will come. And verse 11, he once was, and now is not. And verse 12, he will have their 1 hour of power. It's the nature of all political and human powers that they do not last. They wax and wane. Babylon, that great city, was a ruin by Jesus' day. Rome would fall. Nazism did not conquer all. Putin will die. They may appear huge and unassailable in our day, but their punishment will come. Evil regimes will be swept away, and we shouldn't be surprised when the beast and the woman turn on each other. Did you see that, verse 16? The beast and the ten horns will hate the prostitute. Those once in league with each other will eat themselves. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. The destruction of the prostitute will be carried out. How? Verse 17, for God decreed it, God put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose. After decades of sleaze in Hollywood, there has been a huge backlash against the abuse of actors and actresses. The Me Too movement brought to light what had been hidden in the dark. Perhaps this is saying that will happen on a much grander scale. If God's way of living and ruling a country are ignored, harsh abuses will only grow until in the end, God's judgment will fall. The experience of believers in a fallen world raging against the author of life will be astonishing sometimes in the cruelty and public shaming that they will feel, but the long game is what we must remember we are playing. Verse 14 says, the Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings, and with him will be all his called, chosen, and faithful followers. Phew. What is wisdom? It is to hear the call, to rejoice in the choice God has made to reveal himself to you, and to live in his strength, the faithful life, no matter the opposition that is lined up against you. This is a word for Christians. Stand firm in the face of any evil regime, godless workplace, the ridicule of other parents at the school gate, the mockery of your school friends. The Lamb may not look like much of a match for the beast and the alluring woman and the great city, but the Lamb wins. There is such a thing as being on the right side of history. Revelation gives that sweep of history, and our job in the moment is to live out, to lift our eyes from the Colosseum and the horror in that golden cup and see the Son who has gone to battle for us. Do you remember he's drunk the cup of God's wrath that we might live forever with him? That's the long game. The job every morning as the to-do list piles up is to snatch time in God's word and remind ourselves of what is truly wise and eternal and not be seduced by what is immediate and shiny and comfortable in the moment. So that's for Christians. Here's a word for unbelievers. If you're listening to this, while counted as precious intelligence about the outcome of the war that is waging, and consider switching allegiances while you still can. It calls for wisdom. It may look like you're on the winning side at the moment, and the tide, the river, the flow, they all look like it's going one way and only a tiny minority of believers are going the other. They look so pathetic, like a lamb. Why join them in their lonely fight, you might be thinking, but remember, this is a long game. The lamb does win. And those nagging feelings that this world and all its cultural victories are not actually winning. They're leaving families in a mess, authorities with very little credit, politicians with an impossible job, television that's hard to watch. There are wars and rumors of wars. Some TV programs or Twitter battles leave you with the sense that you've just been at the Colosseum watching horrible human cruelty build as entertainment, and you know it's wrong. Follow those leads. They will lead you to Christ, to the Lamb, to a forgiven fresh start, and to hope for a redeemed future. Revelation 17 is urging you to see the con that is running and not fall for it. Will you bet against the beast and the woman and the city, no matter how powerful they look right now, and side with the Lamb whose blood was shed and whose victory you now know is coming? Play the long game. Consider eternity and join Team Jesus fully and wholeheartedly now. There is no greater team to be on. I put Elliot on a train yesterday evening. He was off to watch a football match. And he needed a lift to the station. He was wearing a big jacket. So I said, have you got the Arsenal scarf to wear when the time comes? And he opened his jacket and showed me his top. He was wearing proudly with a smile. Don't worry, he said, I've got the colours on. As you leave this evening, as you head to work or school, as you head off to wherever it is, will you boldly wear the Team Jesus strip? Wisely watching out for the woman, the city, the beast that are trying on a great con all the time. That's our task. Let's get to it. Before we pray, happy to try any questions, observations or encouragements. And in fact, I'll try and pass on what we had this morning. Do you want to turn to Romans 8? Paul Townsend pointed us to this beautifully. Romans 8, verse 28. Where was that? No. Yeah, 31. If God is for us, who can be against us? Verse 37, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation, no prostitute, no city, no empire, will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. What a great reminder. It's not in your strength that you will resist this temptation. It's in his. And Louise wonderfully pointed us to Hebrews chapter 4. Verse 14. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let's hold firmly to the faith we profess. We don't have a high priest who is unable to feel sympathy for our weaknesses. But we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he didn't sin. How great when you feel a failure and you feel you've given in to the temptation of the allure of the woman or the beast or the city. That he has fought this battle for you and won. And therefore you can approach God's throne of grace with confidence. You may receive mercy and find grace to help you in your time of need. What a great verse to encourage us with. Anything else?
That's really helpful. I can kind of get it with this. I feel like with Revelation, that I look at the bit of it and I understand it. And then I look at the bit and I understand it. And I'm not quite sure how the bits fit together. So I've been trying to listen to it all today. I've only got up to 10, but I will be to listen to the
rest of the whole book. Well done, Carolyn. Fantastic.
But is this supposed to be a cross of, so we have it kind of makes sense until so you get the seals opening. Who can open the seal? Jesus opens the seals. You get all the seals opening, then you get trumpets and the start of all this judgment. Now
bowls.
Then I get a bit confused, because it is it now following this happens and this happens and this happens, or is it actually that you're getting kind of different snapshots from, well, how am I supposed to read this? Am I supposed to read this in a timeline like we're used to reading a novel?
I don't think so.
I find it hard to follow that. Some of it seems quite repetitive.
Yeah,
some of the
That second option you gave us, I think, is the most helpful one.
Because the bowls are quite repetitive, and there's some of the
trumpets and the beasts and the battles. They feel like we're seeing this. It is the same thing, and they're called cycles. And you're looking at these different cycles from different perspectives, and you're seeing trumpets in one, bowls in another, and battles. And I think that way of seeing things, because there's clear splits, there's lots of sevens.
Yeah.
And I think that is what you're meant to see, a repeated confrontation with Jesus opening the seals, pouring out the last bowl, being there to conquer. I think he wins.
Because sometimes you see people read Revelation and they're looking for, you know, parallels with modern day events and things. But in a way, it's a repeated picture of how it will be painful, it will be difficult, and Jesus will win again and again.
And Jesus himself says, no one knows the days or times.
Yes.
Therefore, be ready. Don't try and predict it. That's his.
In fact, he says it earlier. Says it on the previous chapter, doesn't he?
It could be tonight. You ready? I think that's the best way to look at it. Try not to see emperors or power players or cities or specific women. Just see the whole thing. There is a world ganged up against God and his people, and this wonderful affirmation of the Lamb. Hold on, this is who it's written to. All those letters right at the end.
Something, you know, well, that's then, that's that.
Yeah, and the minute
you want to know it,
the minute he said Rome, we would have gone, phew, that's
not that. I'm sorry about that. Yeah. The other thing is that there seems to be, so in several bits, God's people are taken out, and this is a punishment that's happening separate to them.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a few times there's the people dressed in white and there's other stuff going on. In chapter 16, when the bowls of wrath, the God's people are by the sea, they're by him, and they're sort of separate. And yet in other bits, it's clear that they're there and involved. So that's the other thing I find quite confusing is this before? So there's bits that seem to be Jesus has come, he is judged and separated.
Mm-hmm.
There's a separation right at the beginning, because there's always the mark on the heads and the people that are marked, and there's always stuff about who's written. So that's in the book, and that's there's a clear separation and some people, but there's bits in which we're there in the suffering. And there's bits in which we're not. And I'm not sure how does that, because I think, I don't really understand. I don't understand that.
I'm not sure I do either.
So am I to expect to be in a battle? Or am I to expect to be safe with Christ and watching a battle? Or should I just expect what comes and trust Jesus, not really understand it?
No, I think I think expect both with the former.
The answer is yes.
And be humble about that third one. So at times, I mean, look in the New Testament. There are times in the Christian life where to be with Christ is better by far. But I know to be with you, I've got a job to do, Paul says. There are times when he's able to express enormous joy from prison. And there are beautiful psalms that describe being in the house of the Lord. This is better than anything else. And I'm with Christ. I'm with God. And I know it now. But there are other psalms right next to them describe the depths of human experience that just are longing for an end.
Mm.
I think that is normal. There'll be waxing and waning in our experience as Christians. Surely it was the same for the people in exile or the people in the desert. They were by the rivers of Babylon, but they sung songs remembering Zion. They were out of slavery in Egypt, but they weren't yet in the promised land, and they were journeying, and we're in that place too.
God's people aren't suffering God's wrath.
Yes, that's a distinction.
They are suffering in the meantime on Babylon and
the world around.
Fighting us as we try to go in the opposite direction. But that it's suffering, but it's not God's ultimate.
Yeah, and we can count ourselves already seated at the right hand of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But at exactly the same time, we're not yet there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is why Christians facing awful persecution, who truly believe this, face it with courage, and they declare boldly, I'm a Christian. May we have a similar courage in our very comfy, alluring, attractive, powerful society.
I mean, some people who are suffering real persecution and look at us and think we're in a worse situation because what we're fighting is much more difficult to quantify
There's a guy who starts the Discipleship Explored course by saying, I wish on you suffering. And you go, what? Because in suffering is where your faith is refined. It's where you understand who you really believe. It's when you understand Jesus is truly with you. Until you suffer, you don't understand this. He was a Romanian under awful persecution, jailed, but saw 300 people come to Christ as they came through his prison cell. It's a great story.
Mm-hmm.